Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does oil do for a country, and what might it do to a country? While the world's addiction to oil continues almost unabated, many of the countries that possess it in large quantities are failing to provide their citizens with a safe and decent standard of living, let alone sharing the enormous wealth. Peter Maas, who is a contributing editor for the New York Times Magazine, has been reporting on the plight of people in oil-rich countries for years. He brings together much of his work in a chilling new book called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Peter, welcome to Think.
It's good to be with you.
You write that oil undermines most countries that possess it. Before we talk about the places that prove that maxim, tell us first about the notable exceptions and what they seem to have in common with one another.
Well, there are a bunch of interesting exceptions, groups of countries that do very well with oil. I mean, Norway is, of course, the biggest exception of all in the sense that it's a country that depends quite extensively on oil and natural gas and has done incredibly well in terms of having a very well-functioning democracy and a really stable, great economy. It had the benefit, as many countries in this category do, of finding democracy before it found oil. The United States, Canada, these are other examples of oil countries. And one of the reasons that they do so well is also they have a diversified economy. Canada, the United States, obviously lots of other industries. So there's not this great dependence on oil. And, of course, these are countries that also have democracies, and this helps in terms of openness of transactions and making sure that money is spent the way that people want it to be spent and that it's not wasted, et cetera. And then there's another group of countries that do quite well because they simply have so much oil. I mean, a country like Kuwait, a country like Brunei, United Arab Emirates, et cetera, on a per capita basis, they just have so much oil, so much gas that really there's no way for their incomes to not stay very high for, you know, the foreseeable future.
So there really is enough to go around in those places.
In places like that, there is more than enough to go around. And this kind of enables if either the rulers want, and this somewhat the case in Kuwait, the rulers live incredibly well. I mean, they're the ones flying around in their private 747s, et cetera. But it doesn't really matter in a sense because there is so much oil money coming in that even though the rulers might live like this, nonetheless, there's plenty to give good living, good housing standards, good health care to everybody else. There's really not a lot of people even in Kuwait. It's a population that's just, you know, few million total.
On the other side of the spectrum, with a population of only about 600,000, there is Equatorial Guinea. And you write that every dysfunctional oil state is dysfunctional in its own way. But you think Equatorial Guinea might be the most brutalized country on Earth.
Well, it's a really fascinating case. And I went there and ended up after 9 days being expelled on charges of being a spy. It's a really interesting case because Equatorial Guinea, a small country, 600,000, West Africa, it found oil only relatively recently, basically in the mid-1990s. And as it began to export this oil and receive a fair amount of money from the companies that were doing the extracting, this is mostly American oil companies, Chevron, Exxon, Marathon, et cetera, the hundreds of millions of dollars that were being paid in royalties to the government of Equatorial Guinea were actually, as it emerged, being put into secret bank accounts in Washington at Riggs Bank that were held in the personal control of the country's leader, Theodore Obiang, who has been in power for 30 years, came to power in a coup in which he threw out his uncle and then had him executed. And in the last election this country had, which was just last year, the ruling party got 97% of the vote. So it's that kind of a country, and human rights groups basically across the board say that this is one of the most oppressive countries in the world, yet it now has a lot of oil on a per capita basis. It has a lot of American investment. Yet politically, it really isn't changing that much. And the money is just beginning to trickle down a bit.
And virtually all the oil jobs there end up going to workers from other countries.
Well, this is one of the remarkable things. And I don't blame the government of Equatorial Guinea for this so much. There are lots of things that one can blame that government for because it's a terrible one. But I went, for example, when I was there to a Marathon facility. Marathon was building a multi-billion dollar natural gas processing facility, and the manager of the facility took me around in his SUV, and it was your typical kind of construction site for these kinds of facilities. There were cranes, backhoes, workers all over the place. There were like 1,000 or two workers actually on the site at the time. And the remarkable thing is that, of course, the managers of this project were, you know, from Texas, Oklahoma, you know, Scotland, whatever. And then most of the workers who were pounding the nails and working on the cranes and driving the backhoes, they weren't from Equatorial Guinea. They were from India. They were from the Philippines. They were from Bangladesh because these were workers who Marathon had brought in and who were living on the construction site because these were people who had experience on these kinds of big construction sites and could be reliably used to work very well and, 6 or 7 days a week. Whereas locally, the local workforce would have to be trained, and that can be very difficult and time-consuming, and it just made more economic sense. And this isn't a knock against Marathon either. It's just the way that things are. It made more economic sense for Marathon to bring in basically all of the workers that it needed, as well as all of the food it needed, as well as the cement it needed, as well as the lumber it needed. And as a result, it was almost like this whole construction area, which was, 5-10 miles outside of the capital of Equatorial Guinea, it might have been on the moon for kind of like all the connections it had to the local economy itself.
Well, and part of the vicious circle here, and this the irony of this is just really awful, is the fact that human beings who live in Equatorial Guinea often don't have any education, they have no health care, so they're sick all the time, and they literally don't have the physical resources to get themselves to the job site and succeed.
Well, this is one of the things, and again, one can level all kinds of criticisms at the companies and the governments, but, they operate according to basic economic rules that everybody else does. And the fact is that, indeed, the local population is afflicted with a variety of, malaria is one of the diseases, although actually Marathon did begin a program to try to prevent malaria on the island that it was operating. But, indeed, if you have a local population that is not entirely healthy and that is not literate, then indeed it's going to be hard to kind of put them to work and have them work well and have things function well and not have them even be injured, because these workplaces are dangerous places if they're really not qualified or ready for the job. So it's a devilishly tough situation, on top of which, once these multi-billion-dollar facilities, which are so kind of in the construction phase, obviously labor-intensive, but generally speaking in the long run, capital-intensive, you don't need many people working there. Just, 100 or 200 people are working on that site now. So even in the long run, the industry itself, and this isn't a knock against the way the industry operates, it's actually kind of a testament to the efficiency of the industry, it doesn't require a lot of workers. And the problem is that one of the things you want, if you have an economy that you need, no matter if you have oil revenue coming in, you need jobs for people to earn their living. And the industry itself, unfortunately, doesn't really provide that much of it.
I want to go back for a minute to this question of Riggs Bank. This is an American bank based in the nation's capital. This was not money that was being dumped into some Swiss account or somewhere in the Caymans. This was being warehoused in the United States.
It's really quite a shame what happened, because it wasn't just being kind of warehoused. It was actually being dragged in some cases in suitcases in cash from the embassy of Equatorial Guinea in Washington, D.C., over to Riggs Bank by one of the Riggs Bank officials, actually, who went to the embassy fetching suitcases filled with cash, depositing them into the accounts that Obiang had at Riggs Bank, and not even bothering to file suspicious activity reports or anything of that sort, which would alert federal authorities that, hey, maybe there's a problem with these deposits because they're all in cash and they're far, far, far above $10,000. The bank was making a lot of money off of these deposits. It was Equatorial Guinea, and the accounts that it had, the accounts that Obiang controlled, were its largest client. And it was just kind of too good of a thing to turn down. One of the oil executives, in an internal memo that was since disclosed because the Senate began investigating this, kind of just wrote in this memo, this is great. This is Texas tea, how he referred to it. All this money was coming from oil money. And the fact that there were then large amounts of money that were flowing out of these Riggs accounts into kind of banking haven-type places in the Bahamas, et cetera, Riggs Bank, the officials there, were just very happy to go along with it. And fortunately, the law did catch up with them. And indeed, the bank was fined quite severely, and it was eventually taken over.
You mentioned being ejected from Equatorial Guinea while you were investigating on charges that you were spying. Do you think that they truly thought that you were spying, or were they concerned about what you were uncovering about the oil industry there?
I think they were just concerned that I was a Western journalist who was asking a lot of questions. I was going around to different people, kind of asking them, okay, what is the political situation like here? How much is there in the way of liberty, and what happens to the money? Where is the money? Who kind of controls the companies that deal with the Western extractive industries? And basically what happened is that after about 8 or 9 days of me going around and doing this, the information minister starts calling me and texting me and saying, we have to meet, and so we meet. And I kind of knew what was coming, because the government had a reputation for throwing out journalists from time to time. And he said, you're on the next plane out of here. The president is very upset with you. We think that your activities are not correct. You've been talking to the wrong people, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I get to the airport, the information minister has now become extremely exercised, and he starts threatening me. He says I'm a spy, and he demands to go through my belongings again, and he starts slapping my arms. And the only way that actually at this point I could stop it, because he was also talking about taking me back downtown for a real interrogation, was to say to him, look, if you touch me anymore, if you take me downtown for an interrogation, the United States government is going to be extremely upset. Your president is never going to be able to go back to America again, and it's going to be trouble for you. And the thing is, of course, I knew, I mean, this is a bluff. I had no idea what the American government might think if I was taken downtown for an interrogation, but he didn't know. And he then just immediately backed off. It was like I had hit him with a stun gun or something like that. The relationship was so important. The presence of the American companies and their investments were so important that he didn't want to jeopardize it by troubling me. And so in a strange way, oil saved me, but it also revealed to me kind of the troubled relationships that our government and, you know, our people, we Americans, end up having with just absolutely, absolutely terrible regimes for the sake of the oil that they have.
The situation is equally grim in Nigeria, where the discovery of oil has led to more or less constant warfare. Can you talk about what you found there when you went to investigate?
Well, I went there, and I went down to the Niger Delta, which is the area where most of Nigeria's oil comes from, and it's really kind of the best oil that money can find. It's light, sweet, it's easy to refine. And Nigeria has earned about $400 billion in revenue since it began exporting oil. 1960s is when it began exporting oil. But about 80% of the country is now living in poverty, and one out of five children die before they reach the age of five. And in the Niger Delta itself, which is where the oil comes from, the poverty is actually at its most intense, which is the great kind of paradox. The people who live smack dab on top of the oil are the ones who actually live in the greatest amount of poverty. And it's a war zone there now because of this disconnect between the oil that comes out of the ground and the lack of benefits that people see. So in order to travel into the Delta, which is like this kind of Everglades-type region, I didn't need the permission of the Nigerian government. I needed the permission of the local warlord, or one of the major warlords at the time, who agreed to give me kind of safe passage into the Delta. He signed one of his aides to take me there. And so we had to go in a canoe and, you know, go for hours up the Delta and pass by these villages that kind of, you know, were like scorched earth kind of villages, in the sense of they had been attacked by rival militias because there's a tremendous amount of infighting going on there. They'd been attacked by government forces as well. And then also had to kind of go through these, you know, just almost surreal atmospheres where you're in this delta, this creek, and the ground is literally on fire because they're flaring gas that's coming out. There's oil that has come out that's waste oil that they're also kind of burning up. And you really kind of feel like you're in a painting by Hieronymus Bosch or something like that. And it's just, you know, terrible. And the oil facilities that are there, they're like fortresses. I mean, they're you know, guarded by, they have electrified security fences. They have soldiers all around them. And it's kind of a combination of, you know, Waterworld meets Mad Max.
Well, and you mentioned that a lot of the oil is in the Niger Delta. And this is part of the problem in Nigeria, that not every region of the country has similar assets.
Well, this is one of the things that's, you know, curious and difficult about oil overall. And one of the reasons that it can be such a problem, because oil is, you know, never spread evenly anywhere. I mean, even Saudi Arabia, which has the you know, 264 billion barrels of oil, the largest by far in the world, actually its oil assets are very, very narrowly concentrated in the east of the country. And then even in the east, it's concentrated very heavily in, for example, this one big reservoir. And so as the result of that, you have these kind of regional disparities and regional disagreements, and you also have few people who are involved in actually the ownership of the oil, because it's not spread evenly about, like, you know, fields of wheat or something like that. And this concentration of oil, concentration of money, of power, is one of the really unique and often troubling parts of oil itself.
Peter Moss is a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Peter Moss. He's a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine. His new book is called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Peter, sort of proving your theory that oil often does bad things to countries that discover it, can you compare? Things were sort of looking up in Nigeria half a century ago before all this oil was discovered and began to be extracted.
Well, when Nigeria became independent from British rule in the early 1960s, you know, it had a really good farming sector. It had kind of the beginnings of interesting manufacturing and trading sectors. And it had also a very well-educated elite that had been educated in the UK. So for post-colonial societies, it was really looking fairly good. And you can't lay all the problems that Nigeria's had since then on oil, but because it had kind of inherent problems, as any country does, any new country does. I mean, it had, you know, regional differences. It's made up of a very large number of tribes. It has religious differences, et cetera. So, you know, smooth sailing wasn't guaranteed for Nigeria, but what I think most people do agree is that oil made it all the more difficult because it accentuated the regional differences, and it also kind of like accentuated the incentives for bad governance, because government became a matter of trying to get as close to the oil money as you could get, rather than trying to get good programs together, rather than trying to, you know, enhance the manufacturing and the farming sectors. And so, you know, this is one case, and it's kind of the you know, unfortunate poster child for all the bad things that can happen to a country when it discovers a lot of oil, which is not to say that all the bad things that happen in Nigeria are due to oil, but in this case, it certainly didn't help.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Matt in Southlake. Hey, Matt.
Hi. My question was, why you chose a particular wording of the violent twilight of oil, particularly the word twilight?
That's a great question. There are several reasons why. I mean, you know, the first commercial oil well was found in the United States 150 years ago to this year. And oil kind of became the dominant source of the world economy pretty much just before World War I, when Winston Churchill, who was head of the British Navy at the time, decided to switch the Navy over from coal to oil-burning ships. And so, if you look at just what the oil companies here say, that we have perhaps 20 or 30 more years of increasing oil production, and oil is the center of our world economy, a prediction, by the way, which a lot of skeptics disagree with. Nonetheless, if there's only 20 years or 30 years at the most remaining, with oil being the center of our world energy mix, and we've already had a century behind us, well, that's the twilight phase. And in terms of the violence, I mean, you know, this is what I go into the book, obviously. There's been a lot of violence associated with oil in terms of wars that we fight, whether it's in Iraq or other places, or that other people fight. And not only is there the prospect, if we don't manage this transition well, and it doesn't seem like we're doing a great job now, not only is the prospect of more, you know, overt and conventional violence of that sort, but my definition of violence also is a little bit broader. I mean, I think, you know, environmental pollution is a form of violence. I think corruption is a form of violence because it kills people. I mean, if you have oil money that's stolen, that means that roads aren't being built, that hospitals aren't being built, that schools aren't being built, that medicines aren't being bought for the people, and as a result, people die. That is also, to my mind, a form of violence.
What is the relationship between oil assets and terrorism?
Well, this is a question that really goes to Saudi Arabia, of course, and this is where kind of, when you talk about the deformative effects that oil can have on a country, Saudi Arabia is kind of, you know, has its own particular story to tell, and all of these countries have their own stories to tell and have kind of different experiences with oil. Saudi Arabia, of course, incomes there have increased dramatically since oil was first found in that country. There's just no doubt about that. You go to Riyadh or Dhahran or anywhere, and these places virtually didn't exist 50 years ago. But one of the problems, the main problem in a sense, with what oil has done in Saudi Arabia is that a lot of the revenues, as we know, were sent in the last 20 years into Islamic extremist causes. And the result of that is, you know, or one of the results of that is that on, you know, 9/11, 11 of the 15 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, because that country, unfortunately, had become really the kind of locomotive of Islamic extremism. And what's also kind of happening at the same time is that partly because of unemployment problems. Ironically, again, Saudi Arabia with all this oil has an unemployment problem because oil doesn't generate jobs. There's a very large number of alienated youths in Saudi Arabia, and some of them, not all of them, but some of them do end up gravitating towards the meaning that they find, wrongheaded as they are, in violent jihad. And I ran into one of them actually when I was covering the war in Iraq in 2005, and I was in a town, Samarra, a Sunni town, and there was a lot of fighting going on there, and they captured the Iraqi armed forces, a young Saudi, 21 years old. And they said to me, the Iraqis, do you want to interview this guy? And he had just been captured 2 days before. And I said, sure. And I asked him about his life story, and really what it came down to, he was a young kid, he was going to college, but he was aimless, there was going to be no job for him when he graduated from college, and he just had no meaning, was drifting in life, and he was inspired by this call to jihad to go fight the infidels in Iraq, and that's what he ended up doing.
On the other hand, you reject the idea that U.S. involvement in Iraq is and was only about us wanting to control its oil supply. In your mind, that's far too simplistic an argument.
Far too simplistic. I mean, I think the way one kind of poses the question is really kind of crucial, because if you ask, you know, like, do we go to war for oil, then it has to be kind of a black and white answer, yes or no. So I think the way to ask it is not whether a war is about oil, but how it is about oil. Because if you look at, for example, the situation in Iraq, you know, and I was there, I mean, it seems like I'm kind of a zealot lifestyle, but I covered the invasion of Iraq, and I was in Baghdad when the statue of Saddam Hussein was taken down. And then I went, you know, the next days to the oil ministry, and which was surrounded by American troops, and you know, was out there with Iraqis who wanted to get in, Iraqis who worked in the ministry, and they, you know, kind of, they were tearing at my, not tearing at, but they were tugging on my shirt sleeve, saying, look, you know, the Americans are surrounding the oil ministry, the rest of the city is being looted, it's clear that America is just here for oil. Now, they were looking at their history, which is that in 1990-91, when the Iraqi army invaded Kuwait, and it invaded Kuwait for its oil, the United States assembled an international coalition to push Iraq out of Kuwait, because the prospect of Iraq controlling Kuwait's oil, in addition to its own, as well as threatening Saudi oil fields, was just a frightening prospect. That was entirely a war about oil, and it was, you know, there was no doubt about that. It was clear. It was basically explicit even on the part of our government leaders. But actually, in 2003, I think it was much more subtle. I do think oil was a big part of it. But I do think that the fear of weapons of mass destruction was real. I mean, the weapons themselves weren't real. The evidence for it was massaged or concocted in some cases. But I don't think that means that the fear that President Bush or Vice President Cheney and others had about weapons of mass destruction was itself concocted. I think it was real, and that kind of WMD and oil combined in a very volatile way and exploded and you know, created this drive to invade Iraq.
And realistically, another argument that people might not like the sound of, the truth is that the existence of oil wealth within Iraq made it possible to believe that they had the resources to obtain or build weapons of mass destruction.
It certainly does, but, you know, I mean, North Korea has almost, you know, has no oil to speak of, has other minerals, but is an incredibly poor country, but has managed to construct its own nuclear weapons. So you know, poor countries can get nukes. Pakistan has nukes. So, you know, it, of course, adds to the problem, but the problem isn't just that, you know, Saddam Hussein might have nukes, whether or not he had the money, you know, lots of money to make it or not. I mean, he could do it either way, with or without a lot of money. But, you know, one of the kind of threats that this represented is just that this is in the Middle East, and if he has nukes, then he can control the Middle East. We're back to 1990-91 when he was on the verge of controlling basically, you know, all Middle East oil except for what Iran has. So I don't think that the money that oil represents in terms of enabling a regime, you know, in Iran is something that people would cite now, perhaps, to build nuclear weapons is the reason that nuclear weapons get built, because poor countries build nukes too.
So let's move out of the Middle East and talk about Russia and Venezuela. By all accounts, they should be in a better position than many other countries to benefit nationally from their oil wealth. What stands in the way of that?
Well, you know, it depends on the time frame you're looking at, because if you look at Russia in the last 8 years, 9 years or something like that, I mean, incomes as a result of, A, their production increasing in Russia, and B, most particularly in terms of oil prices increasing, Russia has become a vastly more wealthy country in the last 8 or 9 years, and it was kind of saved from what seemed to be collapse because of that. The problem is that, and this happened to the Soviet Union, that when you begin to focus your economy and depend on oil to the extent and natural gas that Russia does, there's not much else, or what other parts of the economy exist can atrophy from lack of attention or lack of incentives or just from macroeconomic impacts of all this foreign currency coming in. And so the result is that if prices fall or if production collapses, then you have instability. In the Soviet Union, there are many reasons for its collapse, but kind of one of the triggers was that oil prices collapsed in the mid-1980s, of course. And this deprived the Soviet Union of money that it needed. And similarly, in Russia, you know, you're kind of like, they're addicted to oil in a similar way as we are. We need it to run our cars. They need it to run their government and pay for all their programs. And so it can be a trap door, particularly a trap door in the sense of it has a tendency to increase and centralize power in the government. And you know, Russia is a country that has had a problem with centralized and much too powerful dictatorial governments in the past. And what we've seen in the Putin era is that, again, yes, incomes have risen, but government power in Russia has risen to an extreme extent so that now there's much less democracy in Russia than there used to be. And there's even more corruption, even though Russia was a very corrupt country before Putin came to power.
And talk for a minute, if you would, about the way the Russian government has sort of orchestrated the distribution and control of oil wealth to ostensibly private citizens.
Well, you know, it's a really fascinating situation. And this, again, is one of the problems with oil, I think, is that who should own it? Because you had a situation in Russia at the during the 1990s, at the end of the 1990s, where most of Russia's mineral wealth, including oil, was controlled by these oligarchs who were private citizens who were able, when the country was kind of on its knees after the collapse of the Soviet Union, to pick up for a song all of these great assets. But the problem was that, okay, the government didn't control the oil, but the private sector did, and so these oligarchs were kind of running the country. And so one of the things that Putin did when he came to power, of course, was to, you know, basically grab back this national wealth from the private sector that had it. And so as a result, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who in my Zelig life I also met, he ended up being arrested, and then basically his company was taken over by the government. And, you know, that was really troubling because it was, disenfranchisement and an expropriation of private property. On the other hand, Khodorkovsky was probably much more powerful than any private citizen should be. I mean, he was virtually able to name ministers back in the kind of troubling days of the twilight of Boris Yeltsin's regime. And he was not necessarily kind of the most ethical of businessmen either. So you're caught between two hard things. If the private sector owns this great store of concentrated oil and power that comes with it, then they can become too powerful. And if the government has the whole thing, it can become too powerful. And this is one of the reasons why it's really hard for countries, a few have, to navigate kind of like who controls oil and how it can be made to benefit everybody.
And so the man who effectively took Khodorkovsky's place is not about to make the same mistake in terms of irritating those in power.
No, I mean, one of the things I did when I was in Russia was that I hung out with the chief executive of Lukoil, which is pretty much now the largest non-state oil company in Russia. And there's a reason why Lukoil still exists as a non-state company. It's that Alek Perov, the chief executive and largest shareholder of it, a billionaire himself, in his office, I visited him in his office, of course, on his desk, instead of, you know, the picture of his wife and child that you would expect to be on his desk, there's a picture of Vladimir Putin. And I looked at it, and I asked him, I said, so what do you think of the president? What's your relationship like with him? And he just looked at me very seriously, and he said, you know, this is a man whom I listen to very carefully and respect very much. And he knew, Alek Perov, that he had two choices. He could either have Putin's picture on his desk and do what Putin wants. Lukoil is a very loyal company to the government. Or he could do what Khodorkovsky did, which is try to be independent, fund the opposition, and in the end wind up in a Siberian jail cell.
We are talking about the new book, Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil, with its author, Peter Must. You can send us email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. Kevin in Dallas writes, it seems to me that these problems have nothing to do with oil, but with what countries do with great natural wealth. These problems have been going on for thousands of years, from the gold the Spanish looted from Central America to the diamonds of South Africa. If not oil, then it will be whatever next resource is valuable and scarce. Is there something special about oil, Peter, or not?
well, there is something special about oil, but there is also a question of kind of like of governance itself. I mean, you know, oil is a kind of intoxicant in a sense, but it doesn't intoxicate everybody. It doesn't have to intoxicate everybody. But resources, when they're concentrated like this, can do that. I mean, you know, Kevin mentioned the Spanish and the gold several hundred years ago. Well, actually, that destabilized Spain in the end. All this kind of, you know, money coming in from the gold and other things that it acquired from its foreign territories actually ended up destabilizing Spain. It's actually the first case that economists kind of cite in what they call the resource curse. So I think he's right. It's not oil itself. I mean, oil is just, what is oil? It's this black substance that's a wonderful source of energy that can do amazing things. It's terrific. But, you know, oil has no army of its own. It has no dogma of its own, no voice of its own. It has effects on what we do, but that's what we do. It's not what oil tells us to do.
Venezuela, meanwhile, is what you describe as a rich country with poor people. Can you talk about how oil essentially creates or contributes to that phenomenon?
Well, the rich country, poor people line is one that I borrowed and gave full credit to from Joseph Stiglitz, who is a Nobel Prize-winning economist. And, you know, his idea, which is part of this whole idea of resources and the troubles that they can but don't always cause, is that you can have countries that have a lot of mineral wealth however, it doesn't trickle down. And Venezuela is a really interesting case because, again, you have to kind of look at almost time periods, slices of time, and to see kind of how oil can have different effects, at different times, because it really wasn't until the 1970s when the price of oil, leapt several fold as a result of the OPEC oil embargo that actually became troublesome for Venezuela. Up until then, and this is the same case actually for Iran, because the oil revenues, you know, weren't really high, and this might sound strange, but because oil revenues weren't high, the countries did better. But actually, in a way, they did. Their growth was steadier. Their growth was stable. In many ways, their political systems were more consistent. But when all this money poured in, things became destabilized. And quite famously, the Venezuelan oil minister in the 1970s, who's kind of credited with being the godfather of or the creator of OPEC, called oil the devil's excrement and warned Terry Lynn Carl, who's great Stanford.
Let me have you stop there, Peter. We need to take a break. Okay. We're talking to Peter Moss about his new book, Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter Moss. He's a contributing editor to the New York Times Magazine and has just published a new book called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Peter, you were talking about the reality that many times growing oil wealth has the effect of destabilizing the countries that have it.
Well, you know, what happens is that you get this rush of money coming in, and it's very difficult for a government to adequately manage, you know, huge new amounts of money coming in. I mean, just look at, you know, what's happening here in America with the stimulus plan. Not to say that we're not doing it right, but it's people are kind of saying like, whoa, you know, all this new money the government's spending doesn't have the capacity to spend it well. Well, if you can imagine a government like, you know, Iran and under the Shah in the 1970s, or, you know, Venezuela in the early 1970s, or some of these countries when there was the most recent spike in oil, they don't have the experience. They don't have the number of technocrats. They don't have the number of people that are necessary to kind of, you know, produce these programs that can use this money well. And so what happens is that all this money comes rushing in, and a lot of it gets wasted. A lot of it gets spent on programs that end up just being white elephants. Some of the money, because there's so much of it sloshing in at these times of high prices, obviously can get stolen. And then there are just purely macroeconomic problems that can occur, which is that you have all this foreign currency coming in, and so the local currency will appreciate. And one of the problems of that is that means that, well, it's cheaper for people in Venezuela or Russia or whatever to buy foreign products than ever was before, so they do that. They don't buy local products. And it becomes more expensive for the exporters in Venezuela or Russia or whatever to export their products because all of a sudden their products are more expensive for foreigners to buy. And so, you know, the result is that you have, you know, destabilization. It's a very difficult thing for governments to navigate. The smart governments do. And Russia is doing some of this. Norway is kind of the leader of all, is that it has Norway a reserve fund, and it basically puts most of the oil money that it gets aside for future generations. It's not invested in Norway. It's not, you know, put into government programs there or anything like that. It is put in basically a savings account invested in foreign stocks, bonds, real estate, et cetera, so that it doesn't destabilize the local economy and so that people there in the local economies don't kind of suffer the exchange rate or other problems that can occur if you dump all this money in all at once. You know, and one of the other ways, actually, that it's dealt with is places like Alaska and also in Canada, they give some of the money directly to the citizens. So rather than the government trying to manage it all, they put it in the citizens' pockets. And that can also be a very efficient, wise way to do things, but it means that governments are essentially kind of giving away some of their power, giving away some of their wealth to the people. And if you have authoritarian governments, they really don't want to do that. They want to keep it for themselves, use it themselves, be in direct control.
And then meanwhile, when they are in the best position to diversify their economies, there seems to be a little incentive to do so.
Well, this is the problem, you know, particularly in a country like Russia, for example. I mean, Russia is just, you know, so important to the world and such a great country, such a just a really important, big country for the world. And when it has all this oil money coming in, it doesn't have to diversify because things are going well. I mean, people in Russia, smart people there, know that, like, we should diversify. But diversifying is really hard. You know, growing and nurturing, you know, new industries or helping ones that exist get off the ground, it's really, really hard. And you almost have to be forced into it sometimes. You know, I lived in South Korea for 3 years. And, you know, the Asian economic miracles were not just because there were some people who had good ideas about how to organize economies, but because these countries had no natural resources to speak of and basically, like, had to create these industries from scratch, and they had to work really hard, and it was difficult. But actually, you know, the longtime leader of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, said it's a couple of years ago, he said, you know, we were lucky not to have oil because it forced us to you know, kind of build our own economy. In Singapore's case, that was a trading as well as industrial economy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you'd like to speak with Peter Moss. Let's go to Wosu in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wosu.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you, I guess, for the risk taking. I know how it is to go to Niger Delta. It's a very difficult place. My question is, we understand there is problem of leadership in these oil developing countries, especially in Nigeria, where the officials are so corrupt. But is there any sense that the oil companies are beginning to change their attitude and behavior in helping these communities that they have neglected? Because they are also part of the problems. They've contributed a lot by neglecting the people.
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
You know, it was really interesting. When I was in the Niger Delta, I went to this village that was called Elam Sangama, and it was a village that Shell had, they had built a little medical clinic. They had, you know, paved the roads. They had built a little kind of, you know, water tower, things of that sort. But actually, the project was kind of a Potemkin project because they built this little medical clinic, but they didn't, you know, provide any medicine or any doctors. And, you know, the local community had no way, they had no resources of their own to actually kind of get beds and get medicine or whatever to make use of this facility that Shell had bought. You know, there was an electrical grid that had been installed, but, you know, the village had no money to pay for kerosene or gasoline for a generator. So, you know, it becomes very difficult for both, you know, the people and the companies to kind of meet at a place where what the company can do kind of reaches what the people really need, because the companies can't do everything. But, you know, when you have a government that's not doing anything, because the Nigerian government is indeed so corrupt, and also there is this conflict system there that makes it very difficult to operate in the Niger Delta. I mean, you know, Shell officials have to be escorted by army troops if they go up the creeks. Most of them are just helicoptered into the facilities. So it's a tricky situation, but I don't want to kind of have it seem hopeless, because there is also what's going on in Nigeria and here in the United States is a very big and great move for transparency, which is, okay, you know, one of the reasons that corruption occurs is because it can occur. Contracts are negotiated in secret. Payments are secret. Nobody can monitor the money, how much comes and what happens to it once it's there. So there's a big movement here in the United States and also in these other countries to force companies and governments to publicly disclose contracts, to publicly disclose payments, that is,
from the source when they go out from companies, and then at the governments when they come in. And there's several initiatives, one called Publish What You Pay, another one called the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, and these are all designed to try to get more transparency in the extractive industries so that it becomes more difficult for corrupt leaders to be corrupt, and that it becomes easier for people to ensure that the money that their resources are being sold for actually reaches their country, isn't stolen, and then is used in productive ways. So you're kind of, in a way, forcing, through transparency, leaders and companies to be more honest and to hopefully avoid some of the problems of bad governance that occurs.
How receptive are oil companies to things like Publish What You Pay?
Well, they kind of give it lip service in the sense like, okay, yes, this is very interesting. Of course, this is something that we'd like to see. But kind of, you know, when the rubber meets the road, unless they have to do it and unless the government they're working with agrees to have total transparency, the companies won't do it because they say, and this is understandable, look, you know, if we publish our contracts, then our competitors will see our contracts, and that's going to put us at a competitive disadvantage. Or they could say, look, you know, if we insist that we publish every single dollar that we pay to the government of let's say, Angola or Equatorial Guinea, then that government's going to find another oil company to deal with. But that's why it's really important that these movements are actually kind of global movements to not just require American companies, but, you know, companies in the UK, companies in France, companies even in China. There's a bill introduced actually just last week in the Senate, a bipartisan bill. Dick Lugar, Chuck Schumer, a couple of others are involved in it. I think it's called the Energy Security Through Transparency Act. And what it would require is that every company registered with the SEC that's involved in extractive industries has to publicly declare, publish any payment above $100,000 that goes to an extractive country. And the beauty of kind of ideas or legislation of this is that it shows the power that the U.S. has to affect change, because most extractive companies, not all, but most, are registered with the SEC because they, you know, raise money in U.S. markets, et cetera. So there are efforts like this which really could do a lot. And, you know, it's not a kind of hopeless situation now at all. In fact, there's a lot of hope because people know what the problem is and they know what some of the answers are.
Let's go back to the phones now and we'll speak with Jerry in Corinth. Hey, Jerry.
Hi. Well, I wanted to ask this question ever since I read the first review of your book. Is how does your thesis work when applied to the United States, to the petroleum producing areas in the United States? Because, you know, we have a number of them. We live in one of them. And you know, but California, for instance, it has petroleum industry and a long series of extractive industries. Really is vibrant, and so is Texas. But if we look next door in Louisiana, it's a kind of a different story. And in some ways, Louisiana resembles a third world more than most third world countries do. And I wonder if you have some explanation for that in your thesis. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
That is a fantastic, fantastic question. And you know, in terms of California, yeah, it had and still has an oil industry, of course, but it also has these other sectors of the economy. And, of course, you know, up until whatever, a few decades ago, I mean, even now, California has an amazing agricultural sector. And, you know, particularly in the last few decades, you know, Silicon Valley and all that, and, you know, the aerospace industry, et cetera. So oil did not dominate the Californian economy the way that it dominates the economy in some of the countries that we've been talking about. And that's really helpful because, again, this diversification so that oil doesn't kind of just, like, you know, take control and all this money take over the economy and the interests of the industry take over the economy. That didn't happen in California so much because it had this incredible diversification and other strong sectors, you know. Texas, you know, that's actually a chapter that I didn't write because I knew that I needed to get into it deeper, but I found it fascinating. What effect has oil had on Texas? And there are people who are listening to this interview right now who know a heck of a lot more about it probably than I do. But I found it really curious. I mean, Texas is an amazing state, and there is diversification, you know, and the educational system, you know, UT Austin, et cetera, fantastic. But there are a lot of indicators according to which Texas, you know, it doesn't have kind of first rank results in terms of health and things of that sort, incomes, et cetera. Now, there are lots of other reasons that, you know, oil doesn't play a part in that can explain some of this. But when you think
just how much money has come up out of the Texas soil over the last, you know, however, 50, 60, 70, 80 years, whatever. A tremendous, tremendous amount. And you know, you would think that Texas would kind of wall-to-wall be much the most wealthy state in the country, perhaps. Not that it, you know, would keep all the wealth for itself, but it's not. And that kind of points to one of these issues. It's just that, you know, like, it can be difficult, even when there's a state that has as much oil as Texas, to end up being kind of, you know, the best educated, the most well cared for in terms of healthcare state in the nation.
Well, and interestingly, too, and this comes up briefly in the book, you know, we have a lot of oil in West Texas and we have a lot of oil in East Texas, but those aren't known to be the centers of the greatest wealth in the state.
Well, yes, and, you know, you also have the problem of bearing the burden of the refining part of the industry. I mean, obviously, the refineries all over the United States, but, you know, Texas has a very large number of refineries. And as well as any company wants to run a refinery, it's a dirty, difficult business, and they don't always do what they should do. I mean, there was a, you know, big explosion a few years ago in Texas City. It was at a refinery, BP, that just did not run it well. And so when you have the oil industry, you know, unless you're Saudi Arabia, which actually, you know, it exports most of it oil unrefined, but, you know, Texas refines a lot of oil, and that's, you know, good for the companies. It makes economic sense to do some of the refinery, a lot of the refining there, but it leaves the state with an industry that, you know, is not a pleasant one to be a next-door neighbor to.
How well did you find the oil industry insiders that you talked to understood the problems that exist around the industry?
I think they understand them really well, in the sense of they you know, these are very smart, well-educated people who traveled around the world. But they say kind of on an individual level there's a limit to what anybody individual can do. I mean, I talked to, you know, a couple of folks or actually many folks in the oil industry, but I'm thinking of two. One, Tim Giffen, another one, Brian Williams. First has been indicted for $80 million of bribery. The other one served a couple of years for tax fraud related to oil deals. And they just made the point to me, like, look, you know, what do you want oil companies to do? You know, if you don't want us to go into these countries where the investment climate is really rough, where people are asking for bribes, which, by the way, we don't give, then we'll just be drilling for oil in London and Paris, and you know, you'll be stepping over manure in the streets of New York because everybody will be riding around on horses. So, you know, one of the chapters, actually, the one that I...
Peter, I'm so sorry that we're out of time. Hopefully people will pick up the book and be able to read all this for themselves. Pierre Maas's new book is called Crude World, The Violent Twilight of Oil. Peter, it has been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.